And secondly, and perhaps as equally important, is that he would not receive a fair trial, and the conditions in the United States were awful. So that's the United States.
And that's Michael Ratner, attorney for Julian Assange. You can hear the rest of that at Law and Disorder Radio. It's time now for the Labor Hour. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. So obviously, by others at the station, there's no editorial, overarching editorial policy here. So comments are welcome. Programming committee at WEF.org, or programming at WEF.org, I guess we'll do it. Thanks again for listening, and be back tomorrow at 5. Still sorting out what that will be.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the June 28th edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour here on WEFT Radio, Champaign 90.1 FM, and streaming on your internet at weft.org. I'm going to be your host today, Bob Polesny, sitting here with the originator of the program and great labor commentator, Bill Gorell. And Bill's going to bring you some of the underwriting announcements here.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information, or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295. That's 328-2295. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to affect excellence, that's with an E, and equity in public education, and to be the, all caps,
the, yes.
Yes.
Like we're shouting
that. Advocacy organization for all public education employees. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And yes, we are proud to have your support. And that's it. But the next one mentions a really cool show that we might tell our listeners about, and that's Rock Geek FM. And when's that on? Is that on later today?
3 o'clock this afternoon.
Yeah,
good with show. With a special guest host, Anthony Santarelli, filling in for William and Christy this week.
Really?
Yeah.
Do they have, what's the theme this week? I know they usually have a theme.
Yeah, know. I don't know.
Rock songs about toenails.
Something like that, yeah, yeah. It'll be up to Anthony.
All right, well, we'll keep you in suspense.
Yeah.
Tune in
at 3 p.m. Yeah.
Anthony
Santarelli.
Santarelli is a rock geek.
He is a rock geek, yeah. And as always, the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
You know something? I have a novel written by the usual rock geek host, William Gillespie.
He's
a called
publisher and editor, yeah. And yeah,
stealing from work.
Really?
Maybe we should get permission to read excerpts from it.
We should. Yeah.
It might be interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll read it first.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask if you read it and if it was very labor related or whatnot.
No, it's kind of.
I think everybody steals from work. They take home pencils or something like that. You know, yeah. But
our jobs, it's like duct tape.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tie Wire. You should know Tie Wire, former Rod Buster.
Yep.
Bob Polesny.
I used Tie Wire out there on the Clinton Power Plant.
Helping to bring nuclear power to Central Illinois.
Yep.
I was there, too. Maybe not the same time.
But. Yeah, I was only there for about 6 months or so. But hey, you were talking about how the GEO is one of the sponsors of underwriters of our program here. I came across a story this week about California grad employee contract shows how reform works. It says this week, 13,000 teaching assistants, readers, and tutors at the University of California ratified a new 4-year contract. It says they made big gains on both bread and butter and social justice issues with a 17% wage increase over 4 years, new language on class size, longer paid parental leaves, a larger child care subsidy with expanded coverage, a new committee to equalize opportunities for undocumented students, and a mandate to create lactation stations and all gender bathrooms. So quite an amazing thing. They say they want to take a quick look back on how they got there. It's their first contract since they had a reform caucus. The Academic Workers for a Democratic Union took the helm of their union, the UAW Local 2865, in the spring of 2011. And it says the AWDU caucus agitated from below. It was a group of graduate students from Berkeley and Santa Cruz who soon linked up with grads on other campuses across the state. They've been active in the 2009 student movement to save California public higher education and were critical of their union leaders for sitting out that fight. So some of the caucus's founders had even been on the bargaining team, but had grown disenchanted with the locals' top-down functioning, and they felt that their union was giving away too much and that winning a decent contract would require mobilizing the rank and file. So contract highlights wages. They want an annual increases of 5%, 4%, 4%, and 3% compounded. That's 17% over 4 years. Class size, management agreed to 2 labor management meetings per year on class size and a mechanism for members to get information about section sizes and student teaching assistant ratios. That'll allow the members to track changes to the ratios and intervene. And rights for members who were parents, they increased the child care subsidy from current level of $600 per quarter and $900 a semester to $900 a quarter and $1,350 a semester available until the child is 12 years old. So interesting things. Childbearing leave, they increased it from 4 weeks paid to 6 weeks paid plus 2 weeks unpaid. Parental leave, they got increases. And like they say, all gender bathrooms. So interesting stuff happening for the California Graduate Employees Union out there.
What's all gender bathroom?
I don't know. Maybe I can read that here in the story. All gender bathrooms, a new anti-discrimination language ensures members' rights to all gender restrooms within a reasonable distance of their workspace. It also establishes ongoing labor management meetings on the issue. So it doesn't really say what all gender means, huh?
Oh, okay, but it means that at the very least, you can't isolate women's restrooms on one, like in the basement. I mean, that's what used to happen in old buildings, you know, and they were just starting to have women, working in them or something.
Yeah.
And on construction jobs, like we mentioned the Clinton Power Plant, I remember there would be like a few women's potty houses scattered throughout the project.
But only like 4 on the whole site or something like that. So they had to walk a mile or something.
Right. And they'd also have to get a key because they were kept locked.
Yeah.
Which I suppose to keep some stupid guy from, you know,
coming in on them or something.
Or being in there when they get there.
Yeah.
That could be scary.
Yeah. Yeah. I got another story here, a little bit about the Supreme Court decision this week. You know, about this Noel Canning decision, and essentially it's about the NLRB and Obama's recess appointments there. So it says, this comes from Working in These Times, it says, though the Supreme Court decided that Obama's 2012 recess appointments to the NLRB exceeded his authority, they have since been approved through the standard process, meaning the board can continue its work. So on Thursday, the Supreme Court unanimously agreed that President Obama overstepped the limits of his power in January 2012 when he appointed 3 members to the National Labor Relations Board during a Senate recess. This is as part of their strategy to stymie all administrative initiatives. Senate Republicans had previously blocked consideration of Obama's nominations, leaving the formerly 5-member NLRB, the principal enforcer of federal labor laws, without the majority it needed to function. Obama responded by appointing 3 new board members during the holiday recess, circumventing the Republican minority's hindrance of the Senate approval process and the president's appointment powers. After they lost a case before the NLRB in 2012, Noel Canning, a Pepsi-Cola bottler in Washington State, challenged the validity of the recess appointments. So in January 2013, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit determined those appointments were indeed illegal. At the time, union leaders were outraged that the appellate court decision had effectively granted a Republican minority in the Senate the power to shut down the principal government agency protecting workers' rights to organize. The Obama administration appealed the decision to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, the NLRB continued to operate. So effectively what was going on there, the Republicans wouldn't allow the Senate, I guess, to go into recess. One of the members would go into Congress, or go into the Senate chambers every 3 days and kind of call it to order or something like that. And even if he was the only person there, and therefore they never really went into recess. So I guess the Supreme Court now has kind of said it's got to be at least a 10-day recess or something like that for any president to go ahead and do a recess appointment. They did declare that recess appointments are legal, which is they've been going on for 100 years or more. Presidents have been doing that. But the fact that the Republicans wouldn't let it officially go into recess, Obama was trying to get around that and stuff. So interesting decision.
I don't, you know, like either side of this. Like the recess appointment is kind of a backdoor thing,
exactly.
But you know, then there's also the log jams being created for political reasons. Neither side in this instance is really being they're being
ethical.
Yeah, you know. That's true. But I, you know, of course, the president would be kind of forced into such a thing in order to keep an operational government.
Exactly.
Going
exactly. Yeah.
With all the obstructions, and
that was the thing. They had refused to debate even his three nominations, so that NLRB was down to two members and stuff, and had been for like 6 months or a year or something like that. So you know they couldn't make any decisions whatsoever. So
yeah, I don't know. Perhaps this is something that needs to be dealt with on a constitutional basis.
Yeah,
because it's obviously a separation of powers issue.
The same thing would apply, I would say, to the FCC and things like that.
Right.
You know, other things where the president appoints those people, and if they just, you know, if the Senate or the House.
Well, there's been a real big problem for years over the judiciary.
Right, right. Blocking appointments and stuff.
And unfortunately, it's happened is becoming packed with extremely conservative judges, you know, farther down the line from the Supreme Court, you know, that people aren't really knowing about or thinking about.
Right, right. Yeah. I got another story here, and then I think we'll get to a little thing that Bill's got kind of queued up over there, but this is Massachusetts is on track to have the highest state minimum wage in the nation. Lawmakers last Thursday gave final approval to legislation that will gradually raise the minimum wage to $11 an hour by 2017, up from $8 an hour today. Governor Deval Patrick received the bill last Thursday, and he's expected to sign it into law soon. So it says, while Massachusetts has taken the lead among states, the city of Seattle recently approved its increase to $15 an hour. They're also pushing for that $15 an hour up in Chicago. There's a caucus of Chicago aldermen up there that are trying to do that as well. So even if the federal government maybe is not taking too much action on that, state and local municipalities are going to go ahead and do that anyway, so that can be a good thing.
Yeah, I wonder what's happening, though, like, say, with an SEIU local that's been representing people for, say, $11 an hour in recent years, you know, and then all of a sudden this minimum thing pops up. I don't know. I haven't heard any discussion of anything like that.
Like
of union people who aren't making $15 an hour yet.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
Even though they're doing better than they would have done before. But anyway, what I'd like to do right now is talk a little bit about the person who I've got on a recording here, and his editorials are available on radioforall.net, and they're also part of a program, I think it's called the Last Draw. An anarchist radio program. But anyway, Sean Swain is a hostage. This is from his website. Sean Swain is a hostage held by the lawless rogue state calling itself, quote, the state of Ohio. He has been held without legal conviction or sentence since 1991 for the self-defense killing of a court official's relative who broke into Sean's home and threatened his life. In fall 2012, prisoners calling themselves the Army of the 12 Monkeys got rowdy at the Mansfield Correctional, and the prison authorities assumed, quote, that anarchist, unquote, Sean Swain, must have been behind it and threw him in supermax isolation. Sean denies any involvement or affiliation with the A12M and is in the process of suing the ODRC for targeting him based exclusively on his ideology and political speech. Sean is the only son of a retired auto worker and a stay-at-home mom. He has renounced his high school diploma, his college degree, and his honorable discharge from the U.S. military. Before being taken hostage, Sean worked as a newspaper columnist and as a union organizer. Sean is mounting his third run for governor of Ohio in 2014. If elected, he promises to decommission the Ohio National Guard, empty Ohio's prisons, and turn them into squats, recognize Native American land rights as set forth by the Treaty of Greenville, arm the tribes with National Guard weaponry to include tanks and helicopters, refuse to sign any budget causing the government to shut down, and sign an executive order making it legal to assassinate him if he remains in office longer than 90 days.
The Army of the 12 Monkeys? Is that?
Yeah, that was a prisoner group that the Ohio officials are saying were somehow influenced or led by Sean Swain, but he denies any knowledge or anything of them at all. But anyway, I like that he's running. He does have some pretty good speeches about running for governor, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, this editorial is about local university educator James Kilgore.
Ah, yes.
Who's recently become controversial at the University of Illinois.
Yep.
For being a former member of the Symbionese Liberation Army who was had been imprisoned for possession of explosives and passport violations, false passport, a man who had lived underground for several years. Those of you older listeners like myself might remember Patty Hearst and the Symbionese Liberation Army saga back in the early or mid-1970s. Ladies and gentlemen, anarchist candidate for governor of Ohio, Sean Swain.
Have you heard about the case of adjunct professor James Kilgore at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign? Kilgore is an interesting guy. In the early 1970s, he was a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army, which makes him a personal hero of mine. The SLA was an urban guerrilla faction, robbed banks, kidnapped Patty Hearst, and, along with the Weather Underground, effectively brought an end to the Vietnam War. As one demand for the release of Patty Hearst, the SLA had Hearst's father, the publishing magnate, deliver millions of dollars in free food to the inner-city poor of Oakland. There's a PBS documentary called Guerrilla about the SLA. It's inspiring. Starting in 1975, Kilgore went underground and lived overseas until 2002. He then came back to the U.S. and pled guilty to possession of explosives, a charge from 1975, and to passport fraud. He served 6 years in prison, and since 2010, Kilgore has been on the faculty of the University of Illinois in Urbana, teaching classes on urban planning and on global studies. After Kilgore effectively organized his community against the building of a new jail in town, a local rag called the News Gazette went on a smear campaign against Kilgore. The paper published a few pieces on him that completely reinvented the facts of Kilgore's SLA involvement. They completely sensationalized the story, with the clear goal of getting Kilgore ousted from his job. Keep in mind, when the University of Illinois hired Kilgore, they knew about his past. He didn't lie about it or try to conceal it. He came into the job interview as a former urban guerrilla with a felony conviction, and was still the best teacher for the job. But under pressure from right-wing headhunters at the local Poison Pen, Kilgore was fired. Since then, a petition has circulated and gained the needed 1,000 signatures in support of James Kilgore. He's gained statements of support from Associate Provost Robin Kaler, and from American Association of University Professors. There's also been a groundswell of support from prisoner rights groups who see the implications of this case for the employment of convicted felons everywhere, 15 million Americans. Personally, I take a different view. I don't believe James Kilgore should fight to make the University of Illinois rehire him. To me, that's pointless. The spineless, hapless university administrators have already proven that they're slaves to perceived public opinion when they fired Kilgore. Well, let him go, under the pressure from the News Gazette. So if Kilgore gets rehired under public pressure, he has to worry for the rest of his life about idiots who managed to mount the counter-campaign of successful pressure again. Kilgore could be hired and fired a dozen times before he retires. Who needs that kind of stress? I think that rather than going back to the university on bended knee with his headless hands, Kilgore should do what he does best. He can organize dozens of former students with whom he developed his best rapport and recruit them for a new project. If the powers that be want to foreclose on Kilgore's efforts to put down the assault rifle and turn over a new leaf and make a new start, perhaps he should pick up the assault rifle and lock and load. He could easily reconstitute the Symbionese Liberation Army, teach former students the strategies and tactics of guerrilla warfare, and start the next campaign with an assault on the News Gazette. Then he could storm the University of Illinois in Atlanta, planning a ski mask, the staccato rhythms of a machine gun to punctuate his arrival. My thinking is, if the gatekeepers of modern culture want to pee on someone trying to go along with the program, they should perhaps have enough sense not to pee on the guy who can assemble an AK-47 in 30 seconds and shoot your face off. Forcing them to deal with a newly constituted urban guerrilla faction, the second incarnation of the Symbionese Liberation Army, would be an excellent way for adjunct professor James Kilgore to teach a valuable lesson. If the system won't accept your peaceful, well-intended participation, use that explosive experience from 1975 and leave a smoking crater where the haters used to be. Shoot first, ask for a job later. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878, Coitsville,
Interesting stuff there from Sean Swain. Some interesting comments on the James Kilgore situation here at the U of I.
Yeah, sorry about the audio quality. I do hope that did make it through. As unfortunate, it's during the most interesting thing he had to say, which was that if he was not allowed to sort of be reintegrated and work in society, that he should then pick his guns back up, organize former students into a new Symbionese Liberation Army, and shoot the faces off of the people at the U of I and the News Gazette, I guess.
I guess that's what he was saying, yes. So
anyway, if he has more relevant things come up, I'd like to bring him in. He's a pretty interesting guy. You can find out more at seanswain.org, and that's SEANSWAIN.org.
Okay. And we should note also that you can find almost all of the World Labor Hour programs uploaded to radioforall.net too on a weekly basis. We try to get them up there a couple days after the program airs here on WEFT Champaign.
And I would also suggest, too, that perhaps you donate some money to radioforall.net. They were recently having problems. They've kind of squared themselves away.
They lost some server space. They had to get some new server space and some new hard drives, evidently. They had some hard drives going bad, and they have archives of shows, our shows, going back for years, right?
Oh, yeah.
You and Peter used to put the show up years ago.
Going back to at least interviews Peter did back in the 90s when we didn't have the ability to really record the show, but he had this fancy Marantz portable tape recorder. It's about four times as big as your laptop computer.
Yeah.
And I think he finagled it with some kind of a grant to do a science show or something. But he had the ability to hook up the phones, and he would record on cassettes, and he could upload those to Radio for All.
Great.
One of my favorite personal interviews, unfortunately my sound quality was often pretty bad, was with Utah Phillips.
Yeah, yeah, I remember you did that one.
About 10 years ago, probably.
Yeah, yeah, that was good stuff. Yeah.
But radioforall.net, I mean, depending on my work schedule, and sometimes if I'm on a job or I can listen to things, I listen to several hours of radioforall.net a week.
Yeah, yeah.
Weird stuff like Bristol Bay Broadband FM with Tony Gosling. And
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff up there.
Oh, and I can't remember the name right now. The From the Grassy Knoll guy.
Oh, yeah.
This sort of weird conspiracy series this one guy does that, with a lot of different things. Apparently the Luciferians are ruling the world through the Jesuits, then through the Queen of England, and lawyers are a big part of it somehow. I don't know. We don't have any rights or anything.
We're waiting for a caller to call in here. We're hoping for a phone interview with Dennis Anderson. He's a candidate for the 14th Congressional District up in the Illinois area, and so hopefully he's going to call in a few minutes. In the meantime, we'll go to a track from Walter Trout. They call us working class, and we ain't working anymore. And just a quick note that Walter did get his liver transplant at the end of May and seems to be doing a great job of recovering and stuff. And
now, do you get it paid for, though?
I don't know. I don't know.
Need some help on that.
We got a brand new Walter Trout CD around here that's getting a lot of airplay on the blues shows these days. It kind of celebrates his 25 years as a solo artist and stuff. So he played with many great bands, but 25 years as a solo artist. Anyway, a little bit of Walter Trout, and hopefully Dennis Anderson will be calling in here in just a few minutes. So stay tuned. I believe our caller's calling in here, so hello, you're on WEFT Champaign. Is this Dennis?
Yes, this is Dennis.
Excellent. We're talking here with Dennis Anderson. He's a candidate in the 14th Congressional District. And why don't you start off and tell our listeners, where is the 14th Congressional District here? It's in Illinois. It's is that up around Chicago area?
Well, it's what's generally referred to. First of all, thanks for having me on. I'm very pleased to be on. The 14th District is basically what is usually referred to as the collar counties. It's sort of the northern edge of Lake County. It doesn't include all of Lake County. It's just a bit of Lake County. McHenry County, Kane County, Kendall County, a little piece of Will, a little piece of DuPage, and a little piece of DeKalb. So
yeah,
parts of seven counties in total on the sort of northern and western edges of the city.
Yeah, interesting. Well, why don't you start off and give our listeners a little bit of a reasons why you're running. I'm sure you've got a few issues that are primary to you. And
sure. Yeah, I'm retired. I retired in 2010 from Loyola University Medical Center in Maywood on the western edge of Chicago. I was the grants and contracts person for the cancer center at Loyola. I'm running basically because I am a citizen candidate, I should mention. I have never run, well, never prior to 2012 had I ever run for elective office. So I'm new to this. I'm not a career politician by any stretch of the imagination. And at the age of 63, I'm not really looking to start a new career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm running primarily because I'm just mad as hell. You know, the Congress that we have, and in particular the House, is, as everybody knows, it's dysfunctional. They're not accomplishing a thing. And more to the point, they're not accomplishing a thing for middle America. You know, they've done nothing with jobs. They've cut unemployment benefits and SNAP benefits. And basically everything that they have done has been counterproductive to working Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And it just angers me. And you know, I could go on other issues, too. I'm concerned about environmental issues and human rights issues, voting rights, and things like that. And these are all areas that this Congress has just chosen not to address. You know, they talk about having passed 40-some jobs bills, but I always urge people to go, and I think you can still find them on Eric Cantor's website, to go onto the web and look at those bills, and you'll find that there are no jobs in them.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, you can call them jobs bills. You can call an empty box a gift, but it's still just an empty box.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I'm just mad as hell.
Excellent. Yeah, I noticed you had some thoughts here about the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the EPA. First of all, I think it's always important to point out to people that the EPA was not born in a vacuum. You know, the EPA was created in response to a pretty sad history with the environment at that time. And it was Richard Nixon, a Republican president, who created the EPA. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm old enough to remember things like acid rain and Love Canal and smog and the Cuyahoga River catching fire.
Exactly, yeah.
And those things resulted in the creation of an agency to protect the environment, and we've been doing some backsliding, and I'm very concerned about it. And the people on the other side of the aisle have clearly demonstrated their interest in weakening the EPA, and
mm-hmm.
that's a serious mistake, particularly when we're facing climate change, which you know, apparently everybody but House Republicans believes is happening.
Right. Yeah.
I'm also extremely concerned. One of my primary motivations is the rate of poverty and unemployment in this country. You know, we've got somewhere in the neighborhood of 22 to 25% of the children in this country are living in poverty, and 50 million households not certain where they're, you know, whether they're going to be able to buy food the next day. And this is just wrong. You know, there is no way to justify that in the richest country in the world. It's a matter of choices and priorities. You know,
right.
We can afford to do what we need to do. And right now what we need to do is take care of people who are hurting.
Right.
And we need to defend their right to work for living wages. You know, the minimum wage absolutely needs to be increased. The SNAP program needs to be fully funded. Unemployment benefits need to be extended.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, as I always say, you don't burn the life jackets when people are in the water. It's as simple as that.
Right. Yeah, income inequality has been increasing in this country for years. I think it's, they say it's at the largest it's been since 1929 or whatnot, when the Great Depression came and stuff. So
yeah, and you know, I don't think you know that people by and large begrudge wealthy people their money. I mean, some people become wealthy by innovation and all that, but when there is such a maldistribution, and when that maldistribution continues to increase, you have to recognize that there is something fundamentally wrong with the way the economy is working. It is not working for the benefit of working Americans. And there is something fundamentally wrong, and we need to address that.
Yeah.
Well, what is what would that fundamental problem be?
Well, I think it has to do with, you know, there are a number of factors. I think that trade agreements have a lot to do with it. You know, we've engaged in these free trade agreements, but where we ought to be looking at fair trade agreements. We need to, as I said, increase the minimum wage. We need to recognize and support the right of workers to organize for greater pay and benefits. You know, I always find it interesting that we constantly see consolidation in the private sector, consolidation of businesses and industries, and that's somehow thought to be okay because it leads to whatever, greater efficiency or what have you. But at the same time, we reject some of those among us, including many in the House, reject the idea that labor has the right to consolidate. You know, labor is an input in the production of goods and services, and the owners of that labor have just as much right to organize and consolidate as does business. It shouldn't be skewed like that. We need to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. And one of the ways to do that, I believe, is to eliminate the ease with which multinational corporations can sequester their money overseas.
Right.
Both escaping taxes and essentially ending up investing overseas. They're creating jobs abroad, and those jobs ought to be created here in the U.S. And the profits of those industries and businesses ought to be taxed here in the U.S. So I think we need to eliminate that incentive. It does middle America no good.
Right. There's a really growing trend lately for American companies to buy up smaller foreign firms so that they can become headquartered overseas in Ireland or something like that, and hide their profits overseas like that and avoid paying taxes in the American system. And that's terrible, like you say. It just hurts the American workers and the country in general.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Well, and actually, to be truly ultra-conservative and go back to, say, the 19th century, you could argue with Republicans that, well, we used to finance this country with tariffs. You're always griping about the income tax. Why don't we bring back tariffs?
Yeah. It's you know, we get caught in this sort of negative feedback loop where goods are produced overseas more cheaply, and they're reimported to the U.S. And they're sold cheaply, and that's, you know, and workers, because their wages have been stagnant for four decades, end up finding that those are the only goods that they can afford, and it's just a negative reinforcement loop, and we have to break that. We have to break that. We have to be able to produce things in this country that people in this country can afford to buy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are new industries on the horizon that we should be looking at. You know, the green energy is one of them that we certainly ought to be investing a lot more in this country.
Definitely.
Because it not only is the obvious benefit to the environment, but it would create jobs here. If we can create these, you know, wind towers and what have you here in the U.S., because I guarantee you, if we don't take action now, I guarantee you that in 10 or 15 or 20 years, we're going to be buying all this stuff from China and Japan and Germany. It's inevitable.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, my name's Bill. You've been talking to Bob mainly, but I've had an idea, and I kind of hatched this particularly in 2009 when I was sitting around with no construction work to do. By the way, I'm a union laborer. I work out of LIUNA Local 703 in Urbana. And I hatched the idea, which I was promoting on Facebook and various places, but never got anywhere, that what we needed, people talk about having an Apollo project level effort. No. I'm not talking about that. The Apollo project did not save the United States from a depression. Okay? World War II did, because it created the most socialized system the United States has ever seen, a command economy to respond to an emergency in a reasonable and logical manner. And what I am saying is that we need a World War II level. That saved us from Hitler, okay? What we need to do is save us from extinction due to climate change. Yeah. And we need a World War II level effort to redo our communication, our education, our transportation, and our energy infrastructures. And I mean World War II level, where it's like you order factories to not to make tanks, but to make wind towers or solar cells or whatever for the effort to save the human race and many other species at the same time.
Well, and you know, another example of doing that sort of thing that sort of parallels the climate change situation is back in the late 50s, early 60s, when I was in grade school, the great effort at science training in school, you know, there was a whole, and it was related to the space race, where the federal government and schools made special effort to train kids in fields that represented the best possibility of addressing the problem or the challenge that the nation saw at the time, which was at that time the space race. And we're facing a similar sort of scientific challenge now, although more critical in so many ways, to address climate change. We don't have time to waste. We don't have time to dilly-dally. We don't have time to debate what is essentially a settled debate on climate change. It's happening. You know, the ice caps are melting, the glaciers are disappearing, disease patterns in the world are changing, and when sea levels, you know, continue, as sea levels continue to increase, we're going to see massive displacements of populations, and that is going to represent the greatest threat to world security that we've seen, you know, possibly ever. You know, when we have mass migrations due to climate change, crops are going to fail. There was a recent report that came out from a business group that analyzed the effects of the probable effects of climate change in Illinois, and it's staggering. I mean, these are business people who are saying we need to act, and we need to act now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the major recent reports was the World Bank. You know, hardly a radical environmental organization. the CIA, the American military.
Yep.
Exactly. Exactly. This is not something to be taken lightly, and it is not something to dilly-dally on. We need action.
Dennis, we're kind of running out of time here. I'm going to change the subject a little bit and ask you about some of your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, maybe single-payer medical and stuff like that.
Okay.
Have a couple quick thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah, I am a great supporter of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, the intention was to reach out and make insurance, health insurance, available to tens of millions of Americans who have been shut out of the system by cost, and it's working. It's working, and you don't hear that much about it anymore from the other side. You know, I'm sure that we'll see more votes to repeal, but we've moved on to Benghazi and the IRS and numerous other so-called scandals, but the Affordable Care Act is working. We've had a terribly, I spent my career in public health and in university health centers, and I understand how the health system works in this country, and it's terribly fractured. You know, it's fee for service, it's public insurance, private providers, it's a lot of unregulated pharmaceutical pricing, and we need to get it under control. We need to control the cost curve, and we do that through greater efficiencies. And who can argue against efficiency? You know?
Correct. Not that the U.S. Congress would have much to say about it, but do you have any thoughts on the Illinois pension situation here?
Well, you know, that is obviously, as you said, it's a state issue. But I can tell you, I am myself a public pensioner. I worked for many years for the state of Wisconsin when we lived there, and collect a pension from the state. But pensions are contracts. They're essentially sacred trusts. You know, people work their lifetimes paying into these things, and they deserve to get out what they were told they would get out. And there's, you know, these were joint agreements, and they need to be honored.
Well, I've got a comment on this. This is not currently a federal or congressional issue. It could be. There is no reason at all why the federal government could not bail out state pension systems.
That's true. That's true.
Except for the moral hazard problem.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But that doesn't seem to matter when it comes to capitalists.
We need to make sure that people's pensions are protected, whether they're public sector or private sector. You know, we've seen too many corporations bail on their obligations.
It's like their little piggy bank.
Yeah. We need to protect that.
Yep. We've been speaking with Dennis Anderson, candidate for the 14th Congressional District here in Illinois. And any closing thoughts, Dennis? And also, how can our listeners find out more about you, Facebook, websites, and things like that?
Yeah, let me start out by saying that I am running against the man who's generally ranked as being the most conservative member of the Illinois Congressional Delegation. His voting record on issues related to health care and labor and the environment is pretty poor. My website is www.dennisanderson14.com, and I'll just give you that one because from there you can link to my Facebook page.
Sure.
And what I can use is, this is a grassroots campaign. This is a much smaller campaign than my opponent will be mounting. I hope to draw him out to debate, but we've been unsuccessful to date. It's a grassroots thing, and I can use any help, whether dollars or boots on the ground, that people have the interest and willingness to offer.
Excellent. Dennis, we really appreciate you calling into the show, and appreciate your thoughts and comments, and wish you well in your race.
Well, thank you very much. And anytime you want to talk to me again, I'm certainly available to you.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks again, Dennis. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Dennis Anderson.
Oh, by the way, folks, his opponent is Randy Hultgren.
Right.
Hultgren. Uh-huh. And Project Vote Smart guesstimates, since he won't actually fill out their form, that he is pro-life, that he supports United States combat operations in Afghanistan. That now here's a good one for somebody as conservative as Hultgren. He would support reducing defense spending to balance the budget.
Okay. Interesting.
But he would not increase anybody's taxes to balance the budget. And he does not support federal spending as means of promoting economic growth. So I doubt if he would go for my World War II level effort to save the planet from
destruction.
Doesn't
sound like it, no.
He does provide supporting tax incentives to businesses for purposes of job creation, which is just the mirror side of spending.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? And and it's not targeted that well. And in fact, you know, here's something that I wondered, and I don't know how to find this out. If there's anybody out there who knows this, please get a hold of us. The big stimulus packages, okay? Large parts of those were some kind of tax breaks for businesses. What I would like to know is how many of those how much money was given away in those tax breaks. I mean, because you can go out and throw out tax breaks right and left, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that people are going to, or businesses are going to qualify, or mm-hmm. if that's enough incentive for them to do something. I mean, if you have no consumer demand, you know, a tax break's not going to make you build a new plant.
Right.
You know, so I was just wondering how much of those advantages were actually taken advantage of, you know, because if they weren't, then the total of the stimulus package would have been smaller by sure. that amount.
Right. Yeah. Interesting thoughts there, Bill.
Well, thank you. It's just I drink too much coffee and things are short-circuiting back and forth.
Have any public service announcements for us here this week?
Well, I do have a toolbox talk from VJ,
yeah.
the company I work for. A positive safety attitude is contagious. You might think of think of Edward Bernays while I'm reading this. We see it all the time. Someone on the work site that refuses to follow the rules, including safety, and encourages others to do the same. They generally have a bad attitude about work and life, and sometimes have other personal issues that compound their problems at work. These few individuals can poison a good safety program by their refusal to comply with established rules and procedures. We have seen the other side of the coin. The worker that follows the rules
yeah.
has good attitude and is a pleasure to be around. Both supervisors and fellow workers wish they had a job site full of these people. Recent studies have shown that roughly 10% of the workers on a work site will do their very best regardless of the situation or how they are led. Negative attitudes of others do not influence these individuals, nor do they intimidate them. They have an excellent work ethic, inherent self-esteem, and they care about other people. These same studies show that another 10% of workers, while unmonitored, will not follow work rules and that they encourage other workers to reject the rules. Furthermore, they complain about their job in general and show disdain for any positive change. The remaining workers, 80%, are basically sheeple who can be influenced positively or negatively depending on how they are supervised. Therefore, leaders are key to the main group's actions. Competent leaders can make the difference and encourage positive attitudes that lead to a safer working environment. Consequently, create and maintain a positive attitude towards safety on the job site by doing your very best to comply with safety rules. It is important to your safety and others as well.
Excellent.
Yes, except that the companies are getting revenge on us for making them have safe conditions for us by really pounding us with personal protective equipment, like mm-hmm. safety glasses that constantly fog up when it's mm-hmm. you're hot and it's sweating. That's real safe. Like, you know, blindness on
yeah.
the job.
Yeah. yeah.
Things like that.
Well, I'm going to give a personal plug for heading out to the Champagne Blues Brews and Barbecue Fest today.
That's correct.
There's good bands out there yesterday, and there's promises to be a whole day full of great blues bands. Rick Estrin and the Nightcats, and who else is out there today? Curtis Salgado, Buckwheat Zydeco, Maurice John Vaughn, and we're going to leave the show here today with a tune from Albert Cummings. He's going to be out there tonight playing from 7:30 to 9 o'clock, and he does a cover of a Merle Haggard tune, Working Man's Blues, so...
Yes.
I'm going to leave
that,
you.
That's kind of from the redneck Merle Haggard
yeah,
period. It yeah. does show a little bit of resentment towards unlucky people that don't have a job. But
yeah.